their chief, an Olympian Jupiter, armed with all his thunders. When the two musketeers had entered, and the door was closed behind them, when the murmuring buzz of the antechamber, to which the summons that had been given had doubtless furnished a new topic, had recommenced, when, lastly, Monsieur de Tréville had paced the whole length of his cabinet 3 or 4 times in silence, but with a frowning brow, passing each time before Porthos and Aramis, upright and mute as on parade, he suddenly stopped directly in front of them, and measuring them from top to toe with an angry look, exclaimed, "Do you know what the king said to me, and that not later than last evening? Do you know, gentlemen?" "No," answered the two musketeers, after a moment's silence. "No, sir, we do not." "But we hope you will do us the honour of informing us," added Aramis, in his most polished tone and with the most graceful bow.
"He told me that for the future he should recruit his musketeers from those of the cardinal." "From those of the cardinal? And why?" demanded Porthos with heat. "Because he saw very well that his thin dregs required to be enlivened by some good and generous wine."
The two musketeers blushed up to the very eyes. D'Artagnan knew not where he was, and wished himself 100 feet below the earth.
"Yes, yes," continued Monsieur de Tréville, becoming more warm. "Yes, his majesty was right. For upon my honour the musketeers cut but a sorry figure at court. Yesterday, whilst playing with the king," the cardinal recounted, "with an air of condolence which much annoyed me, that on the previous day these cursed musketeers, these devils incarnate," and he dwelt on these words with an ironical accent which annoyed me the more, "these cutters and slashers," looking at me with the eye of a tiger, "had loitered beyond closing time in a tavern in the Rue Ferou, and that a picket of his guards, I thought he would laugh in my face, had been obliged to arrest the disturbers. Odd's life, you ought to know something about this. Arrest the musketeers? You were amongst them. You, sirs, do not deny it. You were recognized, and the cardinal named you. But it is all my own fault. Yes, my fault. For I choose my own men. Look ye, Aramis, why did you ask me for a tunic when a cassock suited you so well? Hark ye, Porthos, have you got such a splendid belt only to hang to it a sword of straw? And Athos? I do not see Athos. Where is he?"
"Sir," answered Aramis in a melancholy tone, "he is ill, very ill."
"Ill? Very ill, say you? And of what disorder?"
"We fear it is the smallpox," answered Porthos, anxious to put in a word. "And this would be very distressing, since it would certainly spoil his face."
"The smallpox! Ah, this is a marvellous story you are telling me, Porthos. Ill of smallpox at his age? No, no. But doubtless he is wounded, perhaps killed. Ah, if I were certain of this! Zounds, gentlemen, I do not understand why you haunt such loose places, why you quarrel in the streets and play with the sword in the crossways, and I do not wish you to afford mirth for the cardinal's guards, who are brave men, quiet and skilful, who never throw themselves open to an arrest, and who, moreover, would not allow themselves to be arrested, not they! I am sure they would rather die than be arrested or escape. It is you who fly, who scamper away. A fine thing for the royal musketeers, indeed!"
Porthos and Aramis shook with rage. They could have strangled Monsieur de Tréville had they not perceived that his great affection for them was the foundation of all he said. As it was, they stamped on the carpet, bit their lips till the blood ran, and grasped the hilts of their swords with all their might. Monsieur de Tréville's summons for Athos, Porthos, and Aramis had, as we have said, been heard outside the room, and those who remained in the antechamber had concluded, from the sound of his voice, that he was in a towering rage. 10 curious heads, therefore, rested against the tapestry, and grew pale with anger,
for their ears, glued to the door, lost not one word of what was said, whilst they rapidly repeated the taunting language of their captain to all who were in the antechamber. In an instant the whole hotel, from the door of the cabinet to the outer gate, was in a state of commotion.
"So, the musketeers of the king allow themselves to be arrested by the guards of the cardinal,"
continued Monsieur de Treville, not less excited within than were his soldiers without, but jerking out and mincing his words and plunging them, as one may say, one by one, like poniards, into the bosoms of his auditors.
"So, six of his excellency's guards arrest six of his majesty's musketeers. Sans Dieu! I have taken my resolve. I will go hence to the Louvre, where I shall tender to the king my resignation as captain of the musketeers, and demand a lieutenancy in the cardinal's guards. And if I fail in this, mordieu, I will turn abbé."
At these words the murmurs without broke into a regular explosion. Nothing but oaths and curses were everywhere heard. "Morbleu! Sans Dieu!" and "Death to all the devils!" resounded through the hotel. D'Artagnan hastily glanced around the cabinet in search of some tapestry behind which he might hide himself, and, failing in this, felt an almost uncontrollable desire to get under the table.
"Well, Captain," said Porthos, almost beside himself, "the truth is, we were six against six, but were unawares set upon. And before we had time to draw our swords, two of our party fell dead, and Athos was so grievously wounded as to be scarcely in better plight. You know him well, Captain. Twice he endeavored to rise, and twice he fell back. And yet we did not yield ourselves up. No, we were dragged away by force, but escaped on the road. As for Athos, they believed him dead, so quietly left him on the field of battle, not thinking he was worth carrying away. That is the truth. Zounds, Captain, one cannot gain every battle. Even the great Pompey lost that of Pharsalia, and Francis, who I have heard was as brave as most men, lost the battle of Pavia.
And I can assure you that I killed one fellow with his own sword," said Aramis, "for mine broke at the first parry. Killed or poniarded him, as you please."
"I did not know these circumstances," said Monsieur de Treville, in a somewhat milder tone. "From what I now learn, the cardinal must have exaggerated."
"But I beseech you, sir," said Aramis, who, seeing his captain more calm, ventured to hazard a request. "I beseech you, sir, do not say that Athos is wounded. He would be in despair if it came to the king's ears. As the wound is very severe, having, after passing through the shoulder, penetrated the chest, it is not impossible—" At this moment the door opened, and a noble and beautiful face, but frightfully pale, appeared.
"Athos!" exclaimed both the gentlemen.
"Athos!" repeated Monsieur de Treville himself.
"You inquired for me," said Athos to Monsieur de Treville, in a perfectly calm but feeble voice. "My comrades informed me that you commanded my presence, and I hastened to obey you. Here I am, sir. What do you require me for?" And with these words the musketeer, perfectly arrayed and girded as usual, entered the cabinet with a firm step. Monsieur de Treville, touched to the heart by this proof of endurance, rushed towards him.
"I was just going to tell these gentlemen," added he, "that I forbid my musketeers to expose their lives unnecessarily. For brave men are dear to the king, and his majesty knows that his musketeers are the bravest on the earth. Your hand, Athos!"
And without waiting till he responded to this proof of affection, Monsieur de Treville seized his hand and pressed it with much warmth, and without observing that Athos, notwithstanding his command over himself, uttered a cry of pain and became even more pale than before, if it were possible. In spite of the secrecy which had been observed respecting it, the severe wound which Athos had received was well known to his comrades, and his unlooked-for arrival had produced a great sensation amongst them. The door of the cabinet had, since his entrance, remained ajar,
and as two or three heads were, in the warmth of the general feeling, thrust through the opening of the tapestry, a simultaneous burst of applause followed the last words of their captain. Monsieur de Treville would, doubtless, have sternly and instantly checked this infraction of the laws of propriety, but at the moment he suddenly felt the hand of Athos grasp his own, and on looking at him, perceived that he was fainting. He had rallied all his powers to struggle against his pain during the interview, but he could now no longer sustain it, and fell senseless upon the carpet.
"A surgeon!" cried Monsieur de Treville. "Mine, or rather the king's, a surgeon, or my brave Athos will die!"
At these exclamations of Monsieur de Treville, every one rushed into the cabinet, and before he could stop them, pressed round the wounded man. But this eagerness would have been useless had not the surgeon been found in the hotel. Forcing his way through the spectators, he approached Athos, who was still insensible. And as the pressure of the crowd occasioned him much inconvenience, he directed, as the first step of all, that the guardsman should be instantly conveyed into an adjoining apartment. Monsieur de Treville immediately opened a door and pointed out the way to Porthos and Aramis, who bore off their comrade in their arms. The cabinet of Monsieur de Treville, that place usually deemed sacred, became for the moment an adjunct to the antechamber, and one in which everyone discoursed, talked loud, swore, and consigned the cardinal and all his guards to the infernal regions. In a few moments, Porthos and Aramis re-entered, having left Monsieur de Treville and the surgeon with the wounded man. At length, Monsieur de Treville himself followed, and announced that Athos had recovered his senses, whilst the surgeon declared that there was nothing in his situation to alarm his friends, his weakness being occasioned entirely by the loss of blood. Upon a signal from Monsieur de Treville, everyone now retired except D'Artagnan, who did not abandon his audience, but with true Gascon tenacity held his ground. When all the intruders had left the room and the door was again closed, Monsieur de Treville turned round and found himself alone with the young man.
This is the end of disc number one. Please insert disc number two. This is disc number two.
When all the intruders had left the room and the door was again closed, Monsieur de Treville turned round and found himself alone with the young man. The event which had just taken place had in some measure disarranged the previous train of his ideas, and he therefore now inquired what this persevering visitor required. D'Artagnan repeated his name, and Monsieur de Treville, recalling the past and present, instantly became aware of his situation.
"Pardon," said he, smiling. "Pardon, my dear countryman, but I had entirely forgotten you. What do you want? A captain is merely the father of a family, but burdened with a heavier responsibility than an ordinary parent. For soldiers are great children. But, as I maintain, it is my duty to see that the orders of the king, and more especially those of the cardinal, are carefully executed."
D'Artagnan could not repress a smile, and this smile satisfied Monsieur de Treville that he was not dealing with a fool. Therefore he came at once to the point, and at the same time changed the subject.
"I have loved your father," said he. "What can I do for his son? Tell me quickly, for my time is not my own."
"Sir," said D'Artagnan, "in quitting Tarbes and coming here, I wish to ask from you, as a memorial of the friendship which you have not forgotten, the uniform of a musketeer. But from what I have seen during these last 2 hours, I more fully comprehend the extreme importance of the favor, and tremble lest I may not be deemed a fit recipient."
"It is truly a great favor, young man," said Monsieur de Treville. "But it cannot be so far above you as you believe, or at least seem to believe. However, a decision His Majesty has provided for this case, and I regret to inform you that no one is received among the musketeers who has not passed the ordeal of some campaigns, performed certain brilliant actions, or served for 2 years in some less favored regiment than our own."
D'Artagnan bowed in silence, but at the same time feeling more eager to don the uniform of the musketeers, since that object could only be obtained with great difficulty.
But, continued Monsieur de Tréville, fixing his piercing look upon his countryman, as if he wished to penetrate the inmost recesses of his heart, but for the sake of my ancient friend, your father, I wish to do something for you. Young man, we cadets of Bern are not in general overburdened with wealth, and I fear that matters are not much improved in this respect since I left the province. Your purse, therefore, can scarce be as full as it was.
D'Artagnan drew himself up with a proud air which seemed to say, I ask charity of none.
It is well, young man, it is very well. I understand your feelings. I came to Paris myself with only 4 crowns in my pocket, and I would have fought anyone who had dared to dispute my ability to purchase the Louvre.
D'Artagnan assumed a still prouder air. Thanks to the sale of his horse, he began the world with 4 crowns more than Monsieur de Tréville.
I should say, therefore, that however large may be the sum you really possess, you ought to preserve it. In the meantime, you must perfect yourself in all those accomplishments which become a gentleman, and I will this day write a letter to the director of the Royal Academy, who will receive you tomorrow without any fee. Do not refuse this trifling favor. Gentlemen of the highest rank and wealth often solicit, without being able to obtain it, the same gift. You will there learn to ride, to fence, and to dance. You will form a circle in good society, and from time to time you must personally apprise me of your progress, and let me know if I can do anything for you.
D'Artagnan, ignorant as he was of the manners of high society, felt the coldness of this reception.
Alas, sir, said he, I now deeply feel the want of the letter of introduction which my father gave me for you. I am, in truth, somewhat surprised, replied Monsieur de Tréville, that you should have undertaken so long a journey without that viaticum, so essential to every Bernese. I had one, sir, and a good one, thank God, cried D'Artagnan, but was perfidiously robbed of it.
And with a degree of warmth and an air of truth which charmed Monsieur de Tréville, he recounted his adventure at Meung, accurately describing his unknown adversary.
It was very strange, said Monsieur de Tréville, musingly. You spoke of me openly, did you?
Yes, sir. I certainly committed that imprudence, but such a name as yours served me as a shield on my journey. Therefore you can guess if I frequently covered myself with it or no. It was an age of flattery, and Monsieur de Tréville loved the incense as well as a king or a cardinal. He could not help smiling, therefore, with evident satisfaction. But this smile soon passed away, and returning to the adventure at Meung, he continued,
Tell me, had not this gentleman a slight scar on the cheek?
Yes, as if left by a pistol ball.
Was he not a man of commanding air?
Yes.
Of a tall figure?
Yes.
With an olivine complexion?
Yes, yes, that is he. But do you know this man, sir?
Ah, if I ever meet him, and I will find him, I swear to you, even were he in hell. He attended a woman, did he not?
Continued Monsieur de Tréville.
At least he departed after he'd conversed a moment with the one he had attended. Do you know the subject of their conversation?
He gave her a box, which he said contained her instructions, and desired her not to open it until she arrived in London.
Was this woman an Englishwoman?
He called her my lady.
It is he, murmured Tréville. It must be. I thought he was at Brussels.
Oh, sir, exclaimed D'Artagnan, if you know this man, tell me who and whence he is, and I will hold you absolved even of your promise to admit me amongst the musketeers, for before and above everything else, I long to avenge myself.
Beware, young man, said Monsieur de Tréville. Should you perceive this man walking on the one side of the street, instead of seeking your revenge, proceed yourself on the opposite side. Precipitate not yourself against such a rock,
upon which you will assuredly be shattered like glass.
That fear will not deter me, should I ever meet him, said D'Artagnan.
In the meantime, do not seek him, replied Treville. If you take my advice...
But all at once Monsieur de Treville paused, as if struck by a sudden suspicion. The deadly hatred which the young traveller so openly avowed for this man who had deprived him of his father's letter, which was in itself a very improbable circumstance, might not this apparent enmity conceal some perfidy? Was not this young man sent by his eminence? Did not he come to lay a trap for him? Was not this pretended D'Artagnan an emissary of the cardinal, whom the latter sought to introduce into his house, and whom he wished to place near him to worm himself into his confidence, and afterwards to betray him, as was often done in similar cases? He looked more earnestly at D'Artagnan than at first, and was but slightly reassured by the appearance of that countenance, beaming with acute talent and affected humility.
"I know very well that he is a Gascon," thought he, "but he is just as likely to be one for the cardinal as for me. Yet I will try him further." "Young man," said he slowly, "as the son of mine ancient friend, for I consider the history of this lost letter as true, I wish, in order to compensate for the coolness which you perceived in my first reception, to reveal to you the secrets of our politics. The king and the cardinal are the best of friends. Their apparent disputes are merely to deceive fools, and I do not wish that my countryman, a handsome cavalier, a brave youth formed to rise in the world, should be the dupe of all these pretenses, and, like a simpleton, rush headlong into the snare which has made awful examples of so many others. Rest assured that I am entirely devoted to these two all-powerful masters, and that all my serious proceedings can never have any other object in view than the service of the king and of the cardinal, who is one of the most illustrious geniuses that France has ever produced. Now, young man, regulate your conduct by this, and should you, through your family or connections or even your instincts, bear the slightest hostility towards the cardinal, such as you may have seen burst forth occasionally amongst our nobility, take your leave and quit me. I can assist you in a thousand ways without attaching you to my own person. At all events, I hope my frankness will make you my friend, for you are the first young man to whom I have as yet spoken in this manner."
Treville ceased speaking, but he thought to himself, "If the cardinal has really sent me this young fox, he would not surely fail. He knows how much I loathe him. To tell his spy that the best way of paying court to me is to rail at himself. Therefore, in spite of my protestations, the cunning fellow will doubtless say that he holds his eminence in detestation." The result, however, was far different from Monsieur de Treville's anticipations. D'Artagnan replied with the utmost simplicity, "Sir, I am come to Paris with sentiments and intentions exactly similar to those you have just expressed. My father charged me to obey no one but the king, the cardinal, and yourself, whom he considers the three greatest men in France." D'Artagnan, it will be perceived, added Monsieur de Treville to the others, but he considered that this addition would do no harm. "Hence," he continued, "I have the greatest veneration for the cardinal, and the most profound respect for his actions. It is, therefore, so much the better for me, sir, if, as you say, you speak frankly to me, since you will then do me the honour to esteem this similarity of opinions. But if, on the contrary, as may be very natural, you entertain any feelings of distrust respecting me, so much the worse, as I shall then feel that I am ruined by speaking the truth. But in any case, you will at least honour me with your esteem, which I value more than anything else." Monsieur de Treville was astonished. So much penetration and yet so much candour excited his admiration,
although they failed in wholly removing his doubts. The more superior this youth was to other young men, the more formidable a traitor would he make. Nevertheless, he grasped D'Artagnan's hand and said to him,
"You are an honest fellow, but at present I can only do for you what I have promised. In the meantime, my hotel shall always be open to you, so that, having access to me at all times and being ready to take advantage of every opportunity, you will probably hereafter obtain what you desire."
"That is to say," replied D'Artagnan, "that you will wait till I have become worthy of it."
"Very well," he added, with Gascon familiarity. "Rest assured that you will not have to wait long."
And he bowed to retire, as if the future lay with himself.
"But wait a moment," said Monsieur de Treville, stopping him. "I promised you a letter to the director of the academy. Are you too proud to accept it, my little gentleman?"
"No, sir," replied D'Artagnan, "and I will answer for it that the same fate that overtook my father's letter shall not occur to this, which I will take good care shall reach its destination. And woe be to him who shall attempt to deprive me of it." Monsieur de Treville smiled at this Gasconade, and leaving his young countryman in the embrasure of the window, where they had been talking, sat down to write the promised letter of introduction. In the meantime, D'Artagnan, who had nothing better to do, beat a march on the window, looking at the musketeers, who had followed each other, and watching them rounding the corner of the street. Monsieur de Treville, having written the letter and sealed it, approached the young man to give it to him. But at the very moment when D'Artagnan held out his hand to receive it, Monsieur de Treville was astonished to perceive his protégé spring up, redden with anger, and rush out of the cabinet, exclaiming, "Odd's blood! He shall not escape me this time!"
"And who is he?" demanded Monsieur de Treville.
"It is he, the robber!"
replied D'Artagnan.
"Oh, what a traitor!"
And he vanished.
"Deuce take the madman," murmured Monsieur de Treville. "Unless it is, after all, a clever mode of giving me the slip, seeing that he has failed in his attempts."
4. The shoulder of Athos, the belt of Porthos, and the handkerchief of Aramis. D'Artagnan, quite furious, had passed through the antechamber in 3 bounds and reached the staircase, which he was about to descend by 4 steps at a time, when he suddenly ran full butt against a musketeer who was leaving Monsieur de Treville's suite of rooms by a private door, and butting his shoulder made him utter a cry, or rather a howl.
"Excuse me," said D'Artagnan, trying to continue his course. "Excuse me, I am in a great hurry."
But he had hardly descended the first step before a hand of iron seized him by the scarf and stopped him.
"You are in a hurry," exclaimed the musketeer, as pale as a sheet, "and under this pretext you dash against me. You say, 'Excuse me,' and think that is sufficient. But it is not so, my young man. Do you imagine, because you heard Monsieur de Treville address us somewhat bluntly today, that any one may speak to us as he speaks? Undeceive yourself, comrade. You are not Monsieur de Treville."
"Upon my word," said D'Artagnan, seeing that it was Athos, who, after the treatment of the surgeon, was now returning to his apartments, "upon my word, I did not run against you on purpose, and not having done it on purpose, I said, 'Excuse me.' It appears to me, therefore, quite sufficient. Nevertheless, I repeat, and this time perhaps it is an excess of courtesy, that upon my honour I am in a hurry, a confounded hurry. Loose me, therefore, I beseech you, and permit me to go about my business."
"Sir," said Athos, releasing him, "you are by no means polite. It is evident that you come from a distance."
D'Artagnan had already descended 3 or 4 steps, but at the remark of Athos he stopped short.
"Sir," said he, "from whatever distance I may come, I assure you that you are not the individual to give me a lesson in good manners."
"Perhaps I am," replied Athos.
"Ah, would that I were not in such a hurry," exclaimed D'Artagnan, "and that I were not running after someone."
"Monsieur in a hurry. You will find me without running, do you understand? Near the Carmes des Chaux."
"At what hour?"
"About 12 o'clock.
Very well. I will be there.
Take care that you do not make me wait too long, said Athos. For I tell you plainly, at 12:15, it is I that will run after you and cut off your ears as you go.
Good, exclaimed D'Artagnan. But I will take special care to be there at 12:10.
And he commenced running again, as if possessed by devils, hoping still to catch the unknown, whose slow pace could not yet have carried him beyond his reach. But at the corner of the street, Porthos was talking with one of the soldiers on guard, and between these two there was just space enough for a man to pass. D'Artagnan fancied that this space was sufficient for him, and he shot forward to rush like an arrow between the two. He had not, however, made allowance for the wind, which, whilst he was passing, actually bellied out the enormous cloak of Porthos, into which he fairly plunged. Doubtless Porthos had cogent reasons for not abandoning this most essential portion of his dress, and therefore, instead of letting go the corner which he held, he drew it more closely towards him, so that D'Artagnan found himself rolled up in the velvet by a rotatory motion which is clearly explained by the obstinate resistance of Porthos. D'Artagnan, hearing the musketeer swear, wished to escape from under the cloak, which completely blinded him, and sought for an outlet from the folds. Above all things, he feared that he had injured the freshness of the magnificent belt, of which we have heard so much. But on recovering his powers of vision, he found his nose jammed between the shoulders of Porthos, that is, exactly on the belt. Alas! Like the majority of the fine things of this world, which are only made for outward show, the belt was of gold in front and of simple leather behind. In fact, Porthos, proud as he was, being unable to afford a belt entirely of gold, had procured one of which the half at least was of that metal. And this may perhaps account for the cold under which Porthos had avowed himself as suffering and the consequent need of the cloak.
"Odds bodikins!" cried Porthos, making every effort to free himself from D'Artagnan, who kept poking his nose into his back. "You are mad to throw yourself in this manner upon people!"
"Excuse me," said D'Artagnan, reappearing from beneath the shoulder of the giant. "But I was in a hurry. I am running after someone."
"Do you shut your eyes when you run?"
demanded Porthos.
"No,"
answered D'Artagnan, somewhat piqued.
"No, and thanks to my eyes, I can see what others do not see."
Whether Porthos understood him or not, he yet gave way to his anger.
"Sir," said he, "you will get yourself chastised if you thus rub against the musketeers." "Chastised, sir," said D'Artagnan. "Your expression is harsh. It is such as becomes a man who is accustomed to face his enemies." "Ah, by Saint-Denis," replied D'Artagnan, "I know well that you would not turn your back upon yours."
And the young man, delighted with his joke, marched off, laughing outrageously. Porthos foamed with anger and was hastening after him, but D'Artagnan turned and said,
by and by, when you are without your cloak."
"At 1:00, then, behind the Luxembourg," shouted Porthos.
"Very well, at 1:00.
"'answered D'Artagnan, as he turned into the street adjoining. "'But neither in the street which he had just traversed, "'nor in that down which he looked, did he see anyone. "'Slowly as the stranger had walked, he had disappeared. "'Perhaps he had entered some house. "'D'Artagnan inquired after him of everyone he met. "'He even went down to the ferry, "'returned by the Rue de Seine and La Croix Rouge. "'But no one, actually no one, was to be seen.' This pursuit, however, was so far serviceable to him that, as the perspiration bathed his forehead, his heart grew cool, and he then began to reflect on the events which had just transpired. They were numerous and inauspicious. It was scarcely 11:00, and already the morning had brought with it the loss of Monsieur de Treville's favour, since he must have deemed the mode in which D'Artagnan left him extremely abrupt. Beside this, he had picked up good duels with two men, each of them capable of slaying three D'Artagnans. And lastly, these duels were with musketeers, with two of those very men whom he esteemed so highly as to rank them in his mind and heart above all the world. The fates were against him, sure of being killed by Athos, it is clear our youth did not care much about Porthos. However, as hope is the last thing which is extinguished in man's heart, he began to hope he might survive. It might be, to be sure, with some terrible wounds, and under the impression that he should survive, he gave himself the following rebukes as a guard for the future. "What a hare-brained fellow I am! What a booby! This brave and unlucky Athos was wounded on the shoulder, against which I must therefore run full butt like a ram. The only thing which surprises me is that he did not kill me at once. He would have been justified in doing so, for the pain I caused him must have been excruciating. As for Porthos, upon my word, it is even more droll." And in spite of all his efforts to restrain himself, the youth began to laugh, at the same time looking round lest this solitary merriment, which to those who might see him must appear without cause, should offend anyone passing. "As to Porthos," he continued, "it is more droll. But I'm not the less a miserable giddy-pate to throw myself thus upon people without saying, 'Take care.' And besides, does anyone look under a person's cloak to search for what no one supposes to be there? He would doubtless have pardoned me had I not spoken to him of that cursed belt. It was, it is true, only by insinuation. Yes, but a neat insinuation. I'faith, a pretty business. Foolish Gascon that I am. A pretty kettle of fish I shall make. Come, my friend D'Artagnan," he continued, addressing himself with all the amenity to which he thought himself entitled, "should you escape, which is not very probable, you must practice courtesy for the future. Hereafter, everyone must admire you and must quote you as a model. To be obliging and polite is not to be cowardly. Observe Aramis. He is softness and grace personified. And yet did anyone ever pretend to say that Aramis was a coward? No. And for the future, I will in all points make him my model. Ah, singular enough, here he is." D'Artagnan, thus walking and soliloquizing, had arrived within a few paces of the Hotel d'Aiguillon, and before this hotel he perceived Aramis talking gaily with three gentlemen of the king's guards. On the other hand, although Aramis perceived D'Artagnan, he had not forgotten that it was before this young man that Monsieur de Tréville had given way to passion, and a witness of the reproaches that the musketeers had received was by no means agreeable to him. He therefore pretended not to see him. But D'Artagnan, full of his new-formed plans of conciliation and courtesy, approached the four young men, making them a profound obeisance, accompanied by a gracious smile. Aramis bowed slightly, but did not smile. Silence fell upon the group. D'Artagnan had acuteness enough to perceive that he was an intruder, but he was not sufficiently skilled in the ways of polite society to withdraw himself dexterously from a false position, such as is generally that of a man who joins those he scarcely knows and intrudes himself into a conversation in which he has no interest. He therefore sought within himself for some means of retreat which might be the least awkward, when he suddenly perceived that Aramis had dropped his handkerchief, and, inadvertently, no doubt, had put his foot upon it. The moment appeared to be favourable for repairing his ill-timed intrusion. He therefore stooped down with the most graceful air imaginable, drew the handkerchief from under the musketeer's foot, notwithstanding the efforts he made to retain it there, saying, as he presented it to Aramis, "I believe, sir, this is a handkerchief which you would be sorry to lose." The handkerchief was, in fact, richly embroidered, and had a coronet and arms in one of its corners. Aramis blushed excessively, and snatched, rather than took, the handkerchief from the hands of the Gascon. "Ah! Ah!" said one of the guards. "Will you still insist, most discreet Aramis, that you are on bad terms with Madame de Boistracy, when that gracious lady condescends to lend you her handkerchief?" Aramis threw such a glance at D'Artagnan as makes a man understand that he has gained a mortal enemy. Then, resuming his soft air, "You guess wrong, comrades," said he. "This handkerchief is not mine, and I know not why this gentleman has had the fancy to give it to me, rather than to one of you. And as a proof of what I say, here is my own in my pocket." So saying, he drew from his pocket his own handkerchief, a very handsome one of fine cambric, although cambric at that time was very dear. But it was without embroidery, without arms, and adorned with a simple cipher, that of its owner. This time D'Artagnan was silent. He had discovered his mistake. But the friends of Aramis would not allow themselves to be convinced by his denial, and one of them, addressing the young musketeer with an affected air of solemnity, said, "If the fact is as you assert, my dear Aramis, I shall be compelled to demand possession of the handkerchief, De Bois Tracy being, as you are aware, one of my most intimate friends, and I should not wish anyone to display his wife's property by way of a trophy."
"You make this demand with a bad grace," replied Aramis, "and on this ground alone, even were I to admit its justice fundamentally, I should still refuse compliance with your request."
"The fact is," modestly observed D'Artagnan, "I did not see the handkerchief fall from the pocket of Monsieur Aramis. He had his foot upon it, however, and hence my reason for supposing that it belonged to him."
"And you were mistaken, sir," coldly replied Aramis, not very grateful for the apology.
Then, turning to the guardsman who had avowed himself the friend of De Bois Tracy, he added,
"Besides, on reflection, my worthy comrade, I am the friend of De Bois Tracy as well as yourself, and this handkerchief, strictly speaking, might have come from your pocket as well as from mine."
"No, upon my honour," said the musketeer.
"You swear by your honour, and I pledge my word. Therefore one of us must evidently lie. But come, Montereau, let us do something better than indulge in counter-assertions and denials. Let each of us take half."
"Of the handkerchief?"
"Yes."
"Perfectly fair," cried the other two guardsmen. "Decidedly the judgment of Solomon. Aramis, you are certainly cram full of wisdom," exclaimed the young men, indulging in hearty laughter. And the affair, as may be imagined, was thus deprived of further importance. Immediately afterwards the conversation ceased, and the friends separated, with a cordial shaking of hands, the three guardsmen going one way and Aramis another.
"Now is my opportunity for making my peace with this gentleman," mentally ejaculated D'Artagnan, who had kept somewhat aloof during the latter part of the conversation, and who now, impelled by this good feeling, approached Aramis, who was departing without taking any further notice of him.
"I hope, sir, that you will excuse me," said he, addressing Aramis.
"Sir," rejoined the latter, "you must permit me to remark that you have not acted in this affair as a man of good breeding ought to have done."
"What inference, sir, am I to draw from your remark?"
"Why, sir, I take it for granted that you are not a fool, and that, although coming from Gascony, you must be well aware that no one walks upon pocket handkerchiefs without sufficient reason for so doing. Zounds, sir, Paris is not paved with cambric."
"You do me injustice, sir, in thus endeavouring to mortify me," said D'Artagnan, in whom the inherent love of quarrelling began to operate much more forcibly than his previous pacific intentions. "I am a Gascon, it is true, and as you do not require to be informed, the Gascons are not very long-suffering. Therefore, when they have once apologized, even should it be for some imprudence, they consider that they have done one half more than they ought to do."
"What I have said to you, sir," retorted Aramis, "is not for the purpose of seeking a quarrel with you. Thank God I am no bully, and being a musketeer only temporarily, I never fight except when I am compelled, and then with the utmost reluctance. This, however, is a serious affair, for a lady here is compromised by you."
"Say rather by us," cried D'Artagnan.
"Why did you perpetrate such a stupid blunder as to give me this handkerchief?"
"Why were you so stupid as to let it fall?"
I have declared, and I repeat, sir, that this handkerchief did not come from my pocket.
Well, then, you have twice lied, for I myself saw it fall from your pocket.
Ah, is this the tone you choose to assume, Sir Gascon? Well, I must teach you how to behave better.
And I will send you back to your missal, Monsieur Abbé. So draw, if you please, this instant.
No, I thank you, my fine fellow. Not here, at any rate. Do you not perceive that we are opposite the Hôtel de Guillon, which is full of the cardinal's creatures? In fact, who can say that it is not His Eminence who has commissioned you to procure my head for him? Now, as it happens that I entertain what may appear to you a ridiculous affection for my head, provided it remains tolerably firm on my shoulders, I wish, before parting with it, to kill you. But keep yourself quite easy on that score. I will kill you at leisure, in a retired and secret spot, where you may not be able to boast of your death to anyone.
I am quite agreeable, replied D'Artagnan. But do not be puffed up. And here, take away your handkerchief, whether it belongs to you or not. Probably you may have tears to dry.
Spoken like a true Gascon, sir, said Aramis.
Yes, but that is no reason why you should delay our little affair, unless, indeed, you are influenced by more prudential motives.
I know well that prudence, although indispensable to churchmen, is a virtue unknown to the musketeers, replied Aramis. And being, as I have informed you, only a soldier temporarily, I am resolved to remain prudent. At 2 o'clock I shall have the honour of awaiting you at the hotel of Monsieur de Treville, whence I will conduct you to a more convenient spot. The two young men then bowed to each other and parted. Aramis proceeded towards the Luxembourg, whilst D'Artagnan, finding that the time approached, took the road to the Carme des Chaux, all the while inwardly ejaculating, "Positively, I cannot escape! But at all events, if I am killed, it will be by a musketeer."
5. The King's Musketeers and the Cardinal's Guards. D'Artagnan was friendless in Paris. He therefore went to meet Athos without being provided with a second, having made up his mind to be satisfied with those which accompanied his adversary. Besides, he fully intended to offer the brave musketeer all suitable apologies, but, at the same time, to betray nothing having the slightest appearance of timidity or weakness. He also feared such a result from this duel as may be naturally anticipated in an affair of the kind, where a young and vigorous man fights with an opponent who is wounded and enfeebled, and in which, should the former be vanquished, the triumph of his opponent is doubled, whilst, should the former prove the conqueror, he is not only accused of being brave at small risk, but even his courage is regarded as extremely doubtful. Moreover, unless we have been unsuccessful in our attempt to portray the true character of our adventurer, the reader must have already remarked that D'Artagnan was no common type. Therefore, although he could not divest himself of the idea that his death was inevitable, he had by no means resolved quietly to resign himself to his fate with that patience which another less courageous than himself might perhaps have displayed in such a case. He pondered upon the different characters of those with whom he was about to engage, and at length began to obtain a clearer view of his situation. By means of the sincere apology which he contemplated, he hoped to conciliate Athos, whose aristocratic air and austere manner quite delighted him. Then he flattered himself that he might intimidate Porthos by the adventure of the belt, whose story, if he were not instantaneously killed, he might relate to everyone, so as to overwhelm him with ridicule. Lastly, as regarded the quiet Aramis, he entertained very slight apprehensions, for supposing that he should survive to fight him, he entertained no doubt of his ability to make short work of him, or, at all events, by wounding him in the face, as Caesar recommended his men to do with Pompey's soldiers, to spoil for ever that beauty of which he was so vain.
In fine, D'Artagnan now brought into action those principles of unconquerable and steady resolve which the counsels of his father had implanted in his heart, counsels which, as we know, had instructed him to submit to nothing like indignity, unless it proceeded from the king, the cardinal, or Monsieur de Treville. Full of these ideas, he sped as if on wings towards the convent des Carmes des Chaux, a building without windows, adjoining a chapel of ease of the Pré-au-Clerc, and surrounded by dry meadows, which generally served as a rendezvous for those combatants who had no time to lose. As D'Artagnan came in sight of the small open space in front of the convent, it struck the hour of noon, and Athos had already been about 5 minutes on the ground. He was therefore as punctual as the Samaritan woman, and the most rigorous casuist in the laws of dueling could have found nothing to censure. Athos, who continued to suffer severely from his wound, although it had again been dressed by Monsieur de Treville's surgeon, had seated himself on a large stone, where he awaited his adversary with that air of calmness and dignity which never forsook him. As D'Artagnan approached, he arose and politely advanced some steps to meet him, whilst D'Artagnan, on his part, went towards his antagonist, bowing until his plume touched the ground. "Sir," said Athos, "I expected two of my friends who are to act as my seconds, but they are not yet arrived. I am surprised that they should be so late, as they are generally punctual."
"I have no second, sir," said D'Artagnan. "I only arrived in Paris yesterday. Consequently, I am unknown to anyone here except Monsieur de Treville, to whom I was introduced by my father, who has the honor to claim his friendship."
Athos mused for an instant, and then said, "So, Monsieur de Treville is your only acquaintance?"
"Yes, sir. I know no one but him."
"Oh, then," continued Athos sotto voce, "if I should kill you, I shall acquire the reputation of a child-eater."
"Not entirely so, sir," answered D'Artagnan, with a bow which was not devoid of dignity. "Not quite so, since you do me the honour to draw your sword against me whilst suffering from a wound which must occasion you great inconvenience."
"Inconvenience? Upon my honour, I assure you that you hurt me confoundedly. But I will use my left hand, as I usually do under such circumstances. Yet do not imagine that by this means I do you a favour, as I fight equally well with either hand. Indeed, it will rather be a disadvantage to you, a left-handed man being a very trying opponent to one who is not used to it. I regret, therefore, that I did not apprise you sooner of this circumstance."
"Really, sir," said D'Artagnan, again bowing, "you are so very courteous that I cannot be sufficiently grateful."
"You overwhelm me," replied Athos, with the air of a well-bred man. "If it be not disagreeable to you, pray let us converse upon some other subject. Ah, how you did hurt me! How my shoulder still burns!"
"Would you permit me," said D'Artagnan, somewhat timidly.
"To do what, sir?" inquired Athos.
"I have a salve, which is quite a panacea for wounds, a salve which my mother gave me, and which I have tried upon myself with success."
"And what of it?" continued Athos.
"Why, sir, I am certain that in less than 3 days this salve would cure you, and at the end of that time, when your cure is completed, it would be a great honor for me to cross swords with you."
D'Artagnan uttered these words with a simplicity which did honour to his courtesy, without in the slightest degree detracting from his courage.
"By my faith," exclaimed Athos, "this is a proposition which much pleases me. Not that I should think of accepting it, but it savours of the perfect knight. And it was thus that, in the days of Charlemagne, those brave men whom every man of honour should make his model spoke. Unfortunately, however, we do not live in the times of the great emperor, but in those of the cardinal, and 3 days hence, however well we might preserve our secret, it would be known that we were going to fight, and we should be prevented. But," he added with some impatience, "these seconds are laggards."
"If you are in haste, sir," said D'Artagnan, with the same simplicity that had the moment before characterized his proposition to put off the duel for 3 days, "if you are in haste and should wish to dispose of me at once, dispense with the seconds, I beseech you." "This speech of yours pleases me still more," said Athos, gracefully bowing to D'Artagnan. "It does not seem that of a man who lacks either head or heart. I admire men of your stamp, and, if we are spared, I shall hereafter have sincere pleasure in your acquaintance. Meantime, let us wait for these gentlemen, I pray you. I have plenty of time, and it will be more according to rule. Ah, see, here comes one of them." And as he spoke, the gigantic form of Porthos was seen at the end of the Rue de Vaugirard.
"What!" exclaimed D'Artagnan. "Is Monsieur Porthos one of your seconds?"
"Yes. Have you any objection to him?"
"Oh, certainly not."
"And here is the other." D'Artagnan looked in the direction indicated by Athos, and beheld Aramis.
"What!"
cried he, in a tone of yet greater astonishment.
"Is Monsieur Aramis the other of your seconds?"
"Certainly. Are you not aware that one is rarely seen without the other, and that amongst the musketeers and guards, at court and in the town, we are known as Athos, Porthos, and Aramis, or the Three Inseparables? But as you come from Dax or Pau..."
"From Tarbes," said D'Artagnan,
"you may very naturally be ignorant of all this."
"Really, gentlemen," said D'Artagnan, "you are well named, and should my adventure become known, it will at least prove that like draws to like."
In the meantime, Porthos approached, shook hands with Athos, and turning towards D'Artagnan seemed lost in astonishment. We may mention in passing that he had changed his belt and laid aside his cloak.
"It is with this gentleman that I am about to fight," said Athos, pointing towards D'Artagnan, and at the same time saluting him. "And I also am going to fight him," replied Porthos.
"But not till 1 o'clock," interrupted D'Artagnan.
"And I also. It is with him that I am to fight," said Aramis, who had arrived on the ground just after Porthos.
"Our appointment, however, is for 2 o'clock," replied D'Artagnan, with the same coolness.
"But what are you going to fight about, Athos?" demanded Aramis.
"Upon my faith, I do not well know, except that he hurt my shoulder."
"And you, Porthos?"
"I fight because I fight," replied Porthos, coloring.
Athos, whom nothing escaped, perceived a slight smile curling the lips of the Gascon.
"We had a dispute about dress," said D'Artagnan.
"And you, Aramis?" demanded Athos.
"Me? I fight on account of a theological dispute," answered Aramis, making a sign to D'Artagnan that he wished him to conceal the true cause of their duel.
"Really?" said Athos, who observed D'Artagnan's smile again.
"Yes, a point of St. Augustine on which we could not agree," said the Gascon.
"Decidedly he is a man of spirit," murmured Athos.
"And now that you are all arrived, gentlemen," said D'Artagnan, "permit me to offer my apologies."
A frown passed over the brow of Athos, a haughty smile glided over the lips of Porthos, and a negative sign was the reply of Aramis.
"You do not rightly understand me, gentlemen," said D'Artagnan, elevating his head on which a sunbeam played, gilding its fine and manly lines. "I wish to apologize because it is improbable that I shall be able to pay my debt to all three. For Monsieur Athos has the right to kill me first, which greatly decreases the value of your bill, Monsieur Porthos, whilst it renders yours, Monsieur Aramis, scarcely the slightest value. Therefore, gentlemen, on that account alone, I again repeat my offer of apology. And now, upon your guard!"
And with the most gallant and fearless mien, he drew his sword. His blood was fairly roused, and at that moment he would have drawn his sword against all the musketeers in the kingdom with as little hesitation as he then did against Athos, Porthos, and Aramis. It was 12:15, the sun was at its meridian, and the situation chosen for the encounter was exposed to its fierce heat.
"It is very hot," said Athos, drawing his sword,
and yet I cannot take off my doublet, for just now I perceive that my wound bled, and I fear to distress this gentleman by showing him blood which he has not drawn from me himself."
"True, sir," replied D'Artagnan, "but I assure you that, whether drawn by myself or by any other person, I shall always see with regret the blood of so brave a gentleman. I will, therefore, follow your example and fight in my doublet."
"Come," said Porthos, "a truce to these compliments. Remember that we also await our turn."
"Speak for yourself only, Porthos, when you choose to be so rude," interposed Aramis. "As for me, I consider the courtesies